the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to journey number 123 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring the execution of Joan of Arc. I'm your guide in this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. Well, it's been a while since we've had one of these journeys into history. Seems like we've been suffering from delusions of late, but we're back here with another journey into history. Going back further this time, figured we'd spend enough time in the 1800s. Figured we'd go back a couple centuries and go across the ocean over to Europe. And this time we're going to talk about Joan of Arc. You know, I guess looking back, I don't know whether to apologize or what. You know, this is history, but you know, this is the third time we've had a woman essentially put on trial and or executed for their beliefs. We started out with Anne Hutchinson, and not too long ago we talked about Mary, Queen of Scots. And I know with her, it wasn't only about her beliefs, that there was political motivations and whatnot going on there as well, as far as the monarchy of England. But here again, we have a young woman put on trial because of her beliefs. And I've always been very intrigued by Joan of Arc and her story and her claims. And I can probably get more into that after we listen to the You Are There report and hear from Simon. But I'm glad to be with you again on a journey. And let's get started. Come with me. And let's journey into France in the 16th century.
I was about 10 years old. I was taking a shortcut home through the forest when a strange wind began to blow. It was such a strange sound. Almost like words calling me. Everything was moving so fast. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. God had given me a message. A message to deliver.
What was the message?
He said that I must save France from her enemies and bring her back into the hands of God.
For your King Henry. It is a message from God. Go home. Go now in peace. If you do not go now, you will be buried in this field. I've seen enough blood. But if you want more, I can't stop you. I can only warn you that it will be your blood, not ours. I'm waiting for your answer.
What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us.
want with me? Because I gotta warn you, my dad's a cop. He's not just any cop. He is the cop.
I know who your father is, Joan. He's Will Girardi, born September 4th, 1955, Chicago. His father was Gerald Girardi, his mother was Eleanor Monroe. He had an uneventful childhood, attended Mother Cabrini High School and Morton Junior College. After that, he joined the police force in 1980. And he met your mother, one Helen Brody. She was an art school dropout. You're the middle child of three. About a year and a half ago, your older brother, Kevin, was in a car accident. Fractured his back, left him a paraplegic. You have one other brother, Luke, who's 15. Your favorite color's green. You love salt on cantaloupe. Jim Doss broke your heart in eighth grade. You're afraid of clowns.
Who are you?
I've known you since before you were born, Joan.
I'll ask you one more time.
I'm God.
You're what?
God.
This is John Daly in Rouen, France. The procession which is to take Joan of Arc, the Maid of Orleans, to the stake on this morning of May 30th, 1431, is behind schedule. We had expected that it would be here at the Rouen prison castle in which Joan of Arc is chained in a dungeon, but when we went on the air, we expected it, but evidently something has happened to cause a delay, and the procession is still nowhere in sight. The sentence of the French ecclesiastical court, which condemned her for heresy, is about to be carried out. And unless this 19-year-old farm girl, called by some a saint and by some a witch, admits to having served the devil, unless she bows to the will of the court and recants, Joan of Arc will die in the flames before this hour is over. This crowd outside the prison castle here keeps looking in the direction from which the procession will come. There are some several hundred men, women, and children here. They're Burgundian French, allies of the English, and hostile to Joan of Arc.
May 30th, 1431, Rouen, France. CBS is there.
Joan of Arc faces the stake. The Maid of Orleans can renounce her visions and live, or hold to her faith and die. CBS takes you back 517 years to the day in the Middle Ages that changed the course of French history. All things are as they were then, except for one thing.
CBS is there.
CBS is there, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now...
May 30th, 1431. The prison castle at Rouen and John Daly.
Beautiful spring day, a day hard to reconcile with the grim event that is about to take place, if it takes place. The burning of Joan will be at the old market square here in Rouen, a short distance away from this prison. When the procession arrives, the authorities will make one more effort to break Joan's will. They will bring her from her dungeon to the great hall of the castle, and there they will ask her to sign an instrument of abjuration. If Joan of Arc signs, it is not yet known what her fate will be. But at least she will be saved from the stake. And if she refuses to sign, well, then the procession will take her to the old marketplace where the executioner and a huge crowd are already waiting. However, there is still no sign of the procession, and my colleague Quincy Howe has spent the last few days in an exhaustive investigation of the career of this remarkable girl. And for his report, we take you now to Quincy Howe at our Mobile headquarters.
Never before in history has one person risen so swiftly from obscurity to fame as Joan of Arc, Maid of Orleans. Of all the amazing feats she is said to have performed, none surpasses this. Joan was born 19 years ago in the little village of Domremy, on the left bank of the River Meuse, just west of the Duchy of Lorraine. Her father is Jacques d'Arc, a simple farmer. From childhood, Joan claimed she saw visions of saints and heard their voices. Then one day, St. Michael appeared to her in the radiant figure of a man poised on wings and bathed in dazzling light. St. Michael told Joan that God had appointed her to drive the English invader from the soil of France. He told her to go and lift the siege of Orleans and put Charles the Dauphin on the French throne. In a remarkable series of adventures, this simple farm girl, who can neither read nor write and who dressed like a man, reached the Dauphin and persuaded him to make her commander-in-chief of his armies. Clad in white armor and riding a black charger, She inspired the French soldiers to incredible heroism and won great victories. She drove the English forces and their Burgundian allies from Orleans. She led the Dauphin to Reims, where he was crowned King of France. Then, after she had accomplished her holy mission, the English captured her at Compiègne and handed her over to the French for trial as a sorceress. For months, she confounded her learned inquisitors. Always, she refused to repudiate her visions. Yesterday, the court condemned her, and today she dies, unless she falters when she sees the stake. Men of logic regard Joan's visions as phantoms of her religious imagination. They consider her military success just a barrel of luck. But to thousands of Frenchmen who revere and follow her, she seems indeed a messenger from God. What the future will think is... just a moment. Here comes the procession back to John Daly.
In a solemn march to the prison castle, the procession is led by a delegation of high churchmen, followed by black-robed Dominican monks chanting a litany. There are also English men-at-arms on horseback and an empty tumbril. The castle drawbridge is coming down. Perhaps you can hear the rattle of its chains in the background. At the head of the procession, his lordship, Pierre Fauchon, the Bishop of Beauvais, and chief judge at Joan of Arc's trial. Beside him, the Earl of Warwick, who in the absence of the Duke of Bedford, is the commander-in-chief of the English forces occupying Rouen. The drawbridge is down. The Bishop of Beauvais and the Earl of Warwick have stopped here to talk with the captain of the castle guard. The monks are passing on over the drawbridge into the great hall of the castle, where Joan of Arc will be given her final chance to abjure. I've interviewed both Pierre Cauchon and the Earl of Warwick before during Joan's trial. Pierre Cauchon speaks English, and, sir, here's a question I've not asked you before. Has it ever been officially explained why you were chosen as the chief judge for the trial of the Maid?
It is a simple fact of church government. Jeanne d'Arc was captured in Compiègne. That is part of my diocese. And so it was my duty to try to save her soul.
Your lordship, it has been rumored that you asked for the privilege of trying Joan of Arc because she'd invaded your diocese and driven you out of it 2 years ago.
I am accustomed to the slander of heretics. I pay them no heed.
Well, what are the charges, your lordship, that the Maid's trial was unfair, that two of the judges denounced it as illegal?
Quant à cela, monsieur, I will say to that simply that I was congratulated by my superiors of the University of Paris for the great solemnity and the just and holy spirit in which I conducted the trial.
I see. And do you think, your lordship, that the Maid will recant in the great hall?
Jeanne d'Arc, monsieur, is but 19. At this age, life is sweet. I have high hopes that she will recognize the error of her ways.
And just what is it that you would like the Maid to do?
That is very simple. She must confess that the visions and voices she saw and heard did not come from God and sign an abjuration to that effect.
But the Maid has steadfastly maintained, your lordship, that her visions were divine.
But that is not possible, monsieur. One cannot receive communications from the church triumphant in heaven except in accord with the teachings of the church militant on earth. The heresy of this Maid of Orléans is that she did not consult with the church and submit to its judgment about her visions. If then her visions were not from saints and angels, they must have been from Belial, Satan, and Behemoth.
I see, and that is what the Maid must declare now if she is to be saved.
That is correct, monsieur. We wish to save this child. We are not interested in her body, but her immortal soul. The body burns only for a few moments, but the soul of a sorceress burns through all eternity.
One more question, please, your lordship. There are those who suggest that Joan of Arc was condemned for political reasons.
I do not wish to comment on that.
But if I may, your lordship...
I repeat, I do not wish to comment. I am not interested in politics. I must go now into the question.
Thank you, your lordship. My Lord Warwick.
Huh?
You came with the Bishop of Beauvais, sir. Aren't you going into the castle with him?
Oh, no. The saving of souls is for churchmen. My work today is to be rid of the Maid, and high time, too.
But, my lord, what if the Bishop of Beauvais is right and the Maid recants?
Mark me. He'll soon be coming out with the Maid. We'll see a fire and smell smoke today. I'll wager every pound and every acre I own that Joan will sign no paper.
Do you consider her saint or witch, my lord?
Saint or witch, I know not. But I know the woman. As much as she loves life, she loves what she believes in more. The maid is flesh in her body, but her spirit is steel.
How is it, my lord, that when the English captured Joan of Arc, they didn't put her to death immediately?
If I'd had the say of it, she'd been tied in a bag and dropped in the river. But no, not these French. They have to try her in court. Meddle with words. Very peculiar people, these French. But at least they paid us £10,000 for her.
That's a large sum, my lord.
Not for a wench who drove us out of Orleans and smashed our armies at Patay, who set a weakling on the throne of France. And the damage is not yet done. Ah, though Joan of Arc dies today, we'll not see the end of her yet.
And what do you mean by that, my lord?
But I mean, this maid, this peasant girl, has still a mighty following in unconquered France. These French rebels, they believe her divine. Even after the faggots have made her ashes, I venture they'll cry her name and fight like devils at the sound of it. We'll be hard put to hold whatever soil we've already won.
And is that why you've given orders to have the maid's ashes thrown into the River Seine, my lord?
I want nothing left on which to rear a legend for nourishing the spirit of the French. The memory of this maid will be worth 100 battalions to them. What a pity she was not born an Englishwoman.
Thank you, my lord. The Earl of Warwick has turned to talk with the captain of the castle guard again. The proceedings in the Great Hall must be ready to start. Don Hollenbeck is there to report them, so let's go inside to the Great Hall and Don Hollenbeck.
Joan of Arc has not been brought from her dungeon yet, but everything appears in readiness. The Bishop of Beauvais is seated at a great table in the center of the hall, surrounded by dignitaries. His face is impassive, stern by the flickering light of the many torches that are stuck on the walls and held by the assembled monks. Those torches throw shadows on the walls and on the ceiling of this. Joan is entering the great hall. She is in chains. Her wrists and ankles are manacled. She's wearing women's clothes, a loose gray robe and hood. That's unusual. Joan has always worn men's clothes. It may be a sign that she'll recant. Father Martin Ladvenier, her confessor, is by her side. Joan has reached the table now where Cochon is sitting. The great hall is silent except for the bishop, who is speaking to a priest. Joan is a sturdy girl. She's not beautiful, but there's a winning quality about her, simple and direct, the strength of conviction and inner certainty. She's pale. She shows the strain of 5 months of prison and ceaseless questioning at all hours of the day or night. Her face is calm, almost enigmatic. Pierre Cochon is speaking.
Quoi que l'on appelle la pucelle d'Orléans, écoute bien ceci. Maître a donné lecture de l'acte d'abjuration.
The Bishop of Beauvais has asked Joan to listen to the oath of abjuration, which will be read to her now by Maître Erard, canon of Rouen.
Communément appelée la pucelle, m'avoue coupable du péché de sédition, du péché de désobéissance, du péché d'orgueil, du péché d'hérésie. Je renonce maintenant à tous ces péchés, les abjure et les abandonne, en foi de quoi je signe de mon nom cet acte d'abjuration.
Maître Erard has finished reading the abjuration oath and the confession that Joan has signed and is willing to recant. Now Cochon speaking.
Dans son infinie charité et dans son désir de sauver ton âme, t'offre cette dernière occasion. Que choisis-tu, l'acte ou le bûcher?
Cochon gives her a last chance, the oath or the stake, and now Joan.
Viens d'en haut. Pas d'un pas. Je ne les renierai pas.
Joan has refused to sign the oath. The judges are all shouting at once, urging her to sign, to live.
Mes pères, mes confrères, je vous en prie, ne parlez pas tous à la fois. Vous pourriez vous embrouiller.
Joan has cried out, please, good fathers, please, do not all speak at once. You are liable to confuse yourselves. Cochon speaking again.
Tu refuses encore, Jeanne?
Je refuse.
Tu changeras bien d'avis lorsque tu monteras sur le bûcher et qu'on te liera au poteau. Qu'on l'emmène. Qu'on l'emmène.
Cochon has ordered Joan to be taken from the hall. He said she would yet change her mind when she mounted the scaffold. The monks have begun their chant for the dying. The Bishop of Beauvais and the judges have risen. They are walking out of the great hall. Joan is being led after them. Her refusal to sign the oath of abjuration was quiet but unequivocal. She did not seem to waver for a moment. It seemed as if all her mental torture, her long months of struggle and doubt are over, over at last, and that she is now finally and ultimately resigned to die rather than renounce her blessed saints and angels. However, she has yet to face the terrible ordeal of the stake in the old marketplace. There is still time for her to change her mind and save herself. The procession has passed out of the doors of this great stone hall now, so over to John Daly.
The crowd here has caught sight of the Maid of Orleans. There are some cries of burn the witch, let her burn, but for the most part the people stand looking at Joan in dumb fascination. The procession has just crossed the drawbridge. The maid is standing, still chained, before the empty cart which is to carry her to the old marketplace. Pierre Cochon has raised his hand. The crowd stops its shouting. It's almost silent now. The monks keep chanting, however. The bishop has taken a paper mitre from an attendant and placed it on Joan of Arc's head. There are four words inscribed upon that mitre. I can see them clearly. The words are heretic, relapse, apostate, idolatrous. But now the bishop has motioned to the English men-at-arms. Ecclesiastical officials are thus releasing the maid and turning her over to secular power. The church has only acted as judge. It will not act as executioner. Two English soldiers are lifting the maid into the cart. The crowd pushes forward. He keeps muttering the words inscribed on that paper mitre. Lord Warwick waves the procession forward, and the cart begins to move, the crowd moving with it. The Maid of Orleans leans against the side of the cart, slowly raises her head, and looks down on this crowd. She seems to pity them, not to condemn. Her lips are moving, evidently in prayer. The cart and the procession are moving away, and in a few moments they'll be at the old marketplace where the stake and the executioner are waiting. Ken Roberts is at the old marketplace, so come in, Ken Roberts.
The huge mob here at the old marketplace doesn't know that Joan is on her way. The people are thronging this great square, talking, waiting. Some of them have been waiting since dawn for this spectacle. For to most of the Burgundian French here, this is a kind of show, a kind of circus. They've come to see Joan burn, and they want to see her burn. I'm standing at the foot of the scaffold itself. It's really a double scaffold on two levels or platforms, one higher than the other. The executioner and his attendants stand on the lower platform, and the upper one has the stake and the faggots. To the right of this double scaffold, there is another raised platform reserved to the authorities. The space immediately around the scaffold is guarded by English men of arms, keeping the crowd at a distance. From my vantage point, I can see the entire sweep of this vast throng. People choke the square itself and the streets leading into it. People everywhere on rooftops and at windows. It's a huge mob, a vast mob. And here is one of the French women that is part of it, come to see Joan of Arc burn today. I'm going to ask her whether she thinks Joan may cheat her out of a burning today by recanting. Pardon, madame. Pensez-vous que Jean sera brûlé?
Oh, j'espère bien que je vais brûler. J'ai pas l'intention d'être venue Pont-l'Évêque pour rien voir.
Joan had better burn, she says. She's not come all the way from Pont-l'Évêque. That's about 50 miles west of Rouen to have her holiday ruined.
Oui, il y a un homme qui m'a offert 10 francs d'argent pour ma place près du bûcher.
A man offered her 10 francs for her place here. Alors?
Alors, je lui ai craché à la figure.
She spit in the man's face, she says.
Oui, je suis venue tant pour avoir une bonne place. Et tant qu'on ne me la fera pas.
Merci. She came early, she says, and she won't be cheated.
On me la fera pas.
Merci, madame. Now here's one of the English guards around the scaffold. Soldier, Joan of Arc is on her way here now. What do you think of that?
That's the best news I've heard all morning. The quicker she gets here, the quicker I'll get my dinner.
Well, aren't you more interested in what's going to happen to this girl than you are in your dinner? Do you think she'll weaken and recant?
No matter to me one way or the other, as long as I get something to eat and a draught of ale. This French dust parches my throat something awful, it does.
Thank you, soldier. Now, here's the chief executioner himself, also an Englishman. His name is Geoffrey Ferrage. I've spoken with him before. He wears the familiar black robe and hood of his calling. Master Ferrage, how do you feel about putting Joan of Arc to the stake?
Feel? I have no feeling. It's a matter of business.
Aren't you reluctant about it?
I can't afford such sentiments. If the maid burns, I'm paid. If she doesn't, I'm not.
Thank you, Master Ferrage. Now, here's a gentleman near the scaffold who looks like a scholar of some sort. He seems to be neither English nor French. I beg your pardon, sir. Do you speak English?
I speak many languages, signore.
Would you tell us your name, please?
I am Alfredo Firenze. I travel about Europe collecting rare manuscripts for the library of the House of Medici in Florence.
Oh, I see. You're a Florentine. The Medici is a famous name.
Si.
And what is your point of view on the burning of Joan of Arc today?
As a humane man, I naturally do not want her to go to the stake. But as a man with some regard for the future, I hope she will not flinch from her fiery ordeal.
That's a surprising thing to say. Would you explain it, please, signor?
Si, con piacere. This 19-year-old peasant girl from Doremi does not herself realize the role she is playing on the stage of history. But the flames that rise from this stake will help light a great new political era for Europe.
Political era?
Si.
I don't quite understand, Signor Firenze. It's generally held that the maid has been condemned for religious reasons.
Ah, it is a pity, but people do not always see the truth. One must look for the deeper, the underlying motives.
But isn't Joan's crime heresy?
Si, political heresy, but let us look not at the cover, but at the pages of this book. The church, signor, is strong. Its power is dominant throughout most of Europe. A very young girl, Jeanne d'Arc, has arisen, unwittingly challenging a very old institution. She has dared to put a new French king on the French throne. She has inspired the French people with a new and dynamic spirit. Ah, si. Jeanne d'Arc is not aware of it, but she has helped to create a new state. The established order, signor, does not welcome new states, è vero?
That's an interesting point of view, Signor Firenze, but if that's true, why didn't the English drown the maid as soon as they captured her at Compiègne?
An excellent question, signor, but there is an answer to it. The maid of Orléans has done great damage, no? Si. It can be undone in only one way. She has crowned the French king. There is only one way now to uncrown him, and that is by discrediting him. If Jeanne d'Arc admits that she is a witch, then the French people will say that their new king is the work of the devil, and they will tear him from the throne.
Thank you, Signor Firenze. The crowd around me is calling out, "The witch! The witch is coming!" People on the rooftops surrounding the square are waving, pointing in the direction of the high road from the castle. It must be... Yes, it's the procession. I can see it now, moving through a lane cleared by the English men-at-arms. Tension is spreading through the crowd. It's tightening around the very scaffold itself. People all around me are muttering as if half afraid of the maid's supernatural powers. It's the witch. The witch is coming. I've seen many crowds before, but I've never seen one as fearful and bloodthirsty as this. The burning of heretics is quite customary these days in Europe. Other women have burned before. But this Burgundian mob seems strangely both afraid and yet eager to hear the crackling of the flames. And here is the procession now. It's entering the square. John Daly has come up with the procession in our mobile unit, and he will go to our booth opposite the scaffold and the cart which is just arriving carrying Joan. In a moment, we'll switch to Daly. The monks, still chanting, are taking their places on the upper platform. The crowd is silent. Let's listen.
This is John Daly. At a signal from the Bishop of Beauvais, the monks have stopped their chanting. The cart is now directly before the scaffold. Joan, as she is lifted from the cart, keeps looking at the scaffold. Her eyes seem fascinated by it, but she utters no cry, although her lips are still moving. She is still praying. Pierre Crochon has said something to Joan. I couldn't catch it from here, but whatever it was, Joan has shaken her head fiercely. Lord Warwick has signaled now to the executioner. His assistants have seized Joan. The crowd has suddenly come to life again. This is what they've been waiting for, and they're watching now open-mouthed with anticipation as the executioner's assistants carry the Maid of Orleans up to the scaffold. The Earl of Warwick watches calmly. He just glanced at the Bishop of Beauvais, and Pierre Crochon looked at him for a moment, his face impassive. Now both men are taking their places with the other dignitaries on the platform. The maid is being chained to the stake by the waist and feet. Her hands are free. She has begun to weep, but her lips move still, evidently in prayer. The crowd is silent again. It seems puzzled by Joan's behavior. The people don't know what to make of her. The Bishop of Beauvais looks down at the Maid of Orleans and speaks to her.
The Bishop of Beauvais has asked Joan once again to abjure. She doesn't answer. She's trembling, fighting her tears. This is her last chance. And again, Pierre Cochon has asked, do you abjure, Joan? She raises her head and this time speaks. And once again, finally, she has refused to recant. It was God who sent me, she cried. And now I am going back to him. Tonight, I shall be in paradise. Cochon raises his hand again. The crowd falls silent.
Cochon
is reading the official accusation.
Blasphématrice. De te mêler de magie. De te prétendre.
I have a copy of the official accusation in English. Here is the text, quote, Joan of Arc, we reject you, we cut you off, we abandon you to the fire and the flame. We name you these, we accuse you of these, we condemn you of these. Joan of Arc, sorceress, blasphemer, dabbler in magic, pseudo-prophetess, invoker of demons, superstitious, thinking evil of faith, schismatic, sacrilegious, idolatrous, apostate, profane, disturber of the peace, cruelly athirst for human blood, scandalous, seditious, indecent, immodest. And he concludes, let the sentence for the heretic be carried out. That is the end of the accusation. Cochon has finished reading, and the executioner bends down now to arrange the faggots. Joan of Arc has cried out, give me a cross, give me a cross. The crowd is absolutely silent. No one moves, only the executioner calmly proceeds with his work. And again, Joan cries out for a cross. For the love of God, a cross. A murmur sweeps the crowd, and it's an hysterical murmur. The mood of this mass of spectators seems to have suddenly changed. For only a moment ago, they were crying out almost fiendishly, burn, witch, burn. An English guard has rushed up to the scaffold and handed Joan a cross. It's a rough, wooden cross, seems to have been made hastily from two sticks. Joan of Arc grasps it, raises it to her lips, and now hugs it to her breast. Her eyes are raised to heaven. She's no longer weeping. Yes. She's ecstatic.
Oh, Jésus-Christ!
Dieu pitié! Nous voulons du Père!
And the man has just cried out in terror. The man has just cried out in terror, God help us, we are burning a saint. The crowd has now completely changed. The people are screaming and shouting, stop, stop, don't let her burn. Many have thrown themselves on the ground, are weeping and praying, and even some of the men who condemned her are weeping and praying. But the executioner has put the flame to his torch, and now he is bending and lighting the faggot. The crowd has reacted in one great convulsive protest, and for a moment they're quiet, and then they begin to shout their fear that they have made a catastrophic mistake. They're overcome with guilt and with horror. Too late have revolted against the bloodlust that brought them here.
May 30th, 1431, Rouen, France. Joan of Arc is burned at the stake, but her memory is enshrined in the nation she helped create.
478 years later, Joan of Arc was proclaimed by apostolic brief the victim of expiation for the ransom of France. In 1920, Joan of Arc was canonized. The death of Joan of Arc was another broadcast in the series CBS Is There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The death of Joan of Arc was written by Max Ehrlich and Robert Louis Cheyenne. Next week,
April 22nd, 1889, the Oklahoma land run. CBS Is There.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well, there you go. There's the report. As it happened, you are there. You were there. I was there. CBS was there. Again, I think that CBS and You Are There did a really good job of trying to capture what it would be like there for a live report. And I think you'll be interested in to hear what Simon has to say about this. I found it pretty enlightening. So I think I'll turn it over to Simon Salt, And the rest is history.
Hi, and welcome to The Rest is History. I'm Simon Salt. In today's episode, we're going to look at Joan of Arc. As you were just listening to the execution of Joan of Arc, we're all familiar with the Joan of Arc story, probably. We probably heard it as children in school, how this young woman rose up from obscurity and led the French to victory over the English. But is that true? Is that really who Joan of Arc was? Let's look at who she was first before we talk about what her achievements were. So Joan of Arc didn't really exist. Shock horror. Well, the person did. Her name wasn't Joan of Arc or Jeanne d'Arc. In the Middle Ages, the use of last names or surnames was limited. It was fairly mutable. You could change your name relatively easily. And most people just referred to each other by their first name. They lived in small villages. They didn't really have a need for last names. They knew each other. Of course, with the advent of urbanization, the growth of cities, people started to use last names to differentiate between two people with the same first name. But those last names either referred to where they had come from originally, or their job, or who they were the progeny of. So, for example, Joan d'Arc, or Joan of Arc, implies that she came from a city called Arc, but she didn't. She grew up in Domremy, which is a village in the northeastern France. So that wasn't her name. There's possibility that her name was Jeanne Romay, or possibly Jeanne de Vouthon. These were all names that could have been hers, but she didn't use any of them. In fact, when referring to herself with a last name, she referred to herself only as Jeanne de Pucelle, Joan the Maid, and where we get Maid of Orléans from. So where were these other names from? Well, Romay was possibly her mother's maiden name or her mother's surname. But Romay simply refers to somebody who is a pilgrim, usually a pilgrim to Rome, but certainly could be a pilgrim to another significant religious destination. And in France at the time, there was no shortage of those. The Vouthon name was another that had been attributed to her mother, Isabel. But again, we have no way of knowing if that is the case. So we have this young woman, Joan, or in fact, Jeanne, and we have no real idea who she actually was. We know that she grew up in this small village as the daughter of a farmer and a devoutly Catholic mother. She was brought up in the Catholic faith, and she was taught the rites and rituals of the Catholic faith. Beyond that, we know very little of her childhood. In fact, we do not know for certain her year of birth. It's an estimation that she was 19 years old at the point of her execution. We don't know for certain, as is the case with much of history. So how does this girl who's growing up on a farm become the leader of the French army? Well, around the age of 12 to 13, and again, these ages are hazard, you know, we're guessing at them, she starts to hear voices and have visions. And she interprets these as coming from God. Now, of course, today we still experience people occasionally who are convinced that they have been visited by angels or visited by God himself or herself and been spoken to directly and guided to take some form of action. Now, typically on examination, these people are diagnosed as suffering from some form of mental instability. They may be bipolar, they may be schizophrenic, they may have epilepsy, or they may be suffering from some other kind of psychiatric or neurological disease. They may even have something like brain lesions. And certainly it's been suggested that Joan may even have suffered from bovine tuberculosis. She was, after all, a milkmaid, and so was handling cattle and also drinking unpasteurized milk, both of which have been associated with that disease. And bovine tuberculosis has been known to create seizures and dementia. So we have this young woman who is suffering from some form of mental disturbance, whatever the cause is, and she becomes convinced that she must return France to the French. So who did France actually belong to? At the time, France, as we understand it now, was divided, with much of the north belonging to England and the English-backed Duke of Burgundy. And the Duke of Burgundy was, in fact, trying to build his own empire from what we think of as parts of France, Belgium, Netherlands, and Germany. And he was being backed by the English. The English crown and princes wanted to see him succeed as a way of increasing their own influence. And in fact, even today, the monarch of England, currently Queen Elizabeth II, one of her titles is the Duke of Normandy, which you may remember as William the Conqueror was the first crowned English king who was also the Duke of Normandy. So this is not uncommon, this cross-channel empire, this influence of the English over the French and vice versa was not that uncommon. So we see this land grab, as it were, by the English. We're in the middle of, or towards the end of, the 100-year war. And the English at this point, prior to the appearance of Joan of Arc, were riding a wave. In particular, they were riding the wave of victory at Agincourt, which had been a humiliating defeat for the French. And so the French were very much kowtowed. They had been defeated. The English were governing many of the large cities. And this was something that Joan would have experienced firsthand. She grew up in northern France, which was under English occupation. And so she had seen firsthand what English rule and what potentially the Duke of Burgundy's rule would be like. And she did not agree with this at all. In fact, she wanted to see a France that was made up of French-speaking people with boundaries, borders, that encompassed them. They all spoke a common language and they were ruled by a French king. And so she set out to talk to the king, as she saw him. He would later become Charles VII, known as the Dauphin at the time. He was the heir to the throne, and he was being kept off the throne, of course, by the English. He agreed to see her. How a farm girl got entry to see the prince, we do not know. What she said to him, we do not know. But somehow she convinced him that she was sent by God to lead the French army to rid France of the English and to see him crowned at Rheims. Now, Rheims is the traditional site for the crowning of French kings at the time. And so he was somehow very convinced that this young girl would be able to deliver upon her promises. She acquires some white armor and a horse and is made the general in charge of the French army. Now, consider this for a moment. This is a young girl who has no education. She can't read or write. She has no military background. She has no schooling in military strategy. And yet the prince has made her the head of his military. So these generals that he already had, these chiefs of military, were now put under her control. They weren't too happy about that. They had no confidence that she could deliver what she had promised. But for some reason, they followed her. For some reason, the French soldiers followed her. And one can only assume that it was charisma, that she was such a force of personality, that she was so convinced of her own belief that she was being guided by God, that she was able to convince them as well. So they set off on their first attack to try and take back a seized town. And this is, of course, where Joan gets her name, the Maid of Orleans, from, because she went to relieve the city of Orleans, who was under siege. Now, the battle was fought hard, and she won. She was victorious. And, of course, that in itself cemented her reputation, that, in fact, she had been sent by God to lead the French to victory. After all, what other explanation was there? A 19-year-old farm girl has just led the French to victory. This is incredible. This was the first sustained French offensive in a generation. And here it was being led by Joan. It's not exactly how it happened. Joan, whilst being the nominal head of the army, did not fight. She was a strategist. She stayed behind at the headquarters and made strategy and chivied along the generals and the men, but she did not fight, though she was wounded twice during her time as leader of the French army. She was hit with an arrow in the shoulder and a crossbow bolt in the thigh, but these were not injuries sustained, and she certainly never fought or killed anyone. So maybe not quite the heroine of battle that she is sometimes portrayed, but certainly, without doubt, a charismatic leader. So she has led this successful raid. She goes on to fight two further battles and loses both of them. In the second one, she is captured, and that leads to the trial which you heard. So what does it matter? Why do we remember Joan of Arc? And why is she important? What does her role in history have to do with us today? And that's, after all, the point of history, really, isn't it? It's to understand what the past can tell us about today and the future. Well, let's just think about this for a moment. If the Duke of Burgundy had been successful in keeping the Dauphin from the throne, if he had been successful in building his multicultural, multi-language territory, there would be no modern-day France, or very unlikely. All we would see is an amalgam of places that might have resembled the Hungarian Ottoman Empire, multicultural, covering large amounts of land, probably would have led to what we call today the Balkanization. of Europe and an eventual breaking apart, and we quite probably would never have seen modern France. Had we never seen a modern France, a unified France, we quite probably would never have seen a United States of America. Without French help in defeating the British, the United States wouldn't exist the way it does today. So really, we can look at the United States of America and take its history all the way back to Joan of Arc. Because although Joan was executed, she had put a stop to the Duke of Burgundy. France now had a king and eventually became unified. The Duke of Burgundy's plans fell apart. He did not create a multicultural environment, and instead, modern France was created. So if Joan of Arc succeeded in anything, she succeeded in creating an environment that became liberty, fraternity, and the freedom that we think of when we think of America. So this is why history is important. Now we have a better understanding of why one small event in 1431 impacts us today in 2015. This is Simon Salt, and the rest is history.
Well, thank you, Simon. As always, I appreciate your insight and the different perspectives that you bring to these journeys into history. I talked about being intrigued by Joan of Arc, and I guess, you know, I come at it from a little bit different angle than Simon does. You know, Simon talked about Joan of Arc saying that she received messages from God, that she received revelation from God, and many of these things that happened seemed to be miraculous. You know, he kind of chalked it up to schizophrenia and other mental problems where people hear voices and do these things, and I perfectly understand that. If you've been a listener to the podcast, you know that I'm also a religious man, that I believe in God, that I have faith in Jesus Christ, that He is my Savior. And I don't talk a lot about that on this podcast because, you know, really that isn't what this podcast is about. You know, it's about speculative fiction stories. It's now about history and about Star Wars and many things. But I'm not afraid to talk about religion. I'm not afraid to stand up and say that I believe in God. And, you know, it's part of who I am. It's definitely part of my life. And to go a step further than that, I also believe in revelation. That revelation from God has occurred and does occur. I believe that I can receive personal revelation for myself and my family and anybody that I can help or do something for in the sphere of my influence. You know, I wouldn't say that I could receive a revelation for the entire world, but I believe that there are people that can and have. And, you know, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which was founded on the basis that a young boy received a revelation, instruction from God and from angels, and that over time and many different instances of revelation, that he was able to restore many of the precious truths that had been lost from the earth because of unbelief. And so when I look at Joan of Arc, I do wonder within myself if God did work through her to free France and to make this possible and set the stage for other things. You know, I definitely believe that God sees things far greater than I can or that we can fathom here on this earth. We can put the pieces together and we can learn things from science and from history. And it's important that we seek out those things, but that God has a greater perspective. and he works in mysterious ways, as they say. Mysterious to us, because we only see a small part of the picture where he can see the whole thing. So to me, it's quite possible that Joan of Arc did receive revelation from God. But I don't know. You know, this maybe she didn't. There's not enough known, I guess, to really answer that question for me. But it's interesting to me on many levels, you know, definitely as a figure in history. As Simon said, you know, so much is not known about who she was and where she came from and these types of things. But nobody's doubting that these things did happen. And so it's interesting. I like some of these mysteries in history as well as knowing all the facts. So I hope you enjoyed this. I will be beginning our Edgar Allan Poe celebration soon. It'll probably be June and July, where we delve into the many stories and things of Edgar Allan Poe. I have a lot of cool things lined up for you. I am working on the production of the Ken Scholes Poe story. I've had that for a few weeks now, and things are coming together on. I think you'll really like his story and hopefully the production. I got some great voices and narrators for it, so come back in a week or two and we'll delve into that. But until then, kids, stay safe out there and journey on.
What I'm trying to say here is that the Journey Into podcast is created under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. You know what that? Basically, what I'm saying is you can't change it. And you can't sell it. But otherwise, you can share it with everybody you want. Throw that up on Facebook. You know, put it all up on your MySpace page. You can do all kinds of things with it. Just make sure you don't try and profit from it. Also, you should probably know that the music in this show is provided by Man in Space.
Are you spying on me?
I'm omniscient, Joan. Comes with the job.
Okay. So you're God?
Yes.
As in God?
Right.
Old Testament, Tower of Babel, burning bush, Ten Commandments. God.
Well, I come off a little friendlier in the New Testament and the Quran, but yeah, same God.
And I'm supposed to believe you because...
Because you have a feeling.
Don't.
How about you believe me if I agree to overlook that promise you didn't keep?
What promise?
Let's see, that you'd study hard, stop talking back, clean your room, and even go to church, if I recall, if I let your brother live.
How did you know about that?
Omniscience. Look it up.